In the demo, the fly moves through a virtual environment toward a food source, shown as slices of banana. Along the way, simulated dust collects on the fly, and when enough dust builds up, then the fly stops and it grooms itself. These scientists connected two major things, a digital brain model and a digital body model. And I'm sure right about now, you guys can easily imagine what kind of horrors this could spell for the human race, especially in like a prison or a punishment sort of capacity. The email, dated August 5th, 2018, goes, "Attached is the doc you requested. It's the use of funds spreadsheet for the designer baby and human cloning company."
He Zhenkuai stunned the scientific community with the claim he pushed the boundary no one else had.
A line has been crossed that should not have been crossed.
It's very disturbing. It's inappropriate.
Oh, this is huge.
But when I heard that there were live born children from it, I thought, oh my gosh, he just jumped ahead.
I'm just saying, if all of this is 20-year-old research and they're already mapping brains into digital landscapes, guys, while most people would not be willing to necessarily sell their DNA, it is legal regardless for dozens of private corporations to claim ownership over every single cell in our bodies, and those claims would be completely upheld if challenged in a U.S. court of law, and that is the real horror. You don't own nothing, you will own nothing, and you will be happy, and that includes your very body. These clones are stored on site and activated to work at the cloning center during the dreams without any pay or compensation, and you thought your job sucked.
Beamed from a payphone buried under a theme park that nobody remembers building, and decoded by a substitute teacher with a ham radio and three missing teeth. Welcome one and welcome all to 21CDTV, hosted by the uncontrolled opposition, an ex-interrogator that they call the CIA Boogeyman. Ask the dangerous question, what if the human body was never meant to be in public at all? We investigate a man who insists that his clone has been ruining his credit score, and then we need a survivalist to build a bunker for something he says already happened next week. Now, please give a legally cautious welcome to a certified 21st century dystopian, the G-host, Johnny Jakes.
In the future, there's a country that should not exist. It's called Opium. A thin, poisoned strip of land wedged between the United States and what was once Mexico. Opium is not really a nation in the ordinary sense. It has no noble founding myth, no dream of liberty, no sacred constitution. It's a machine, a plantation state, a narcotic kingdom built on poppy fields, armed borders, silent servants, and human beings who have been reduced to property. And at the center of it all sits one man, Mateo Alacran, El Patron, the boss. He is more than a drug lord, more than a dictator, more than the head of a crime family. He's a living relic, over 140 years old, kept alive by wealth, science, fear, and the bodies of others. His estate is the heart of Opium. And the Alacran family lives around him like insects trapped in amber, waiting for the old man to finally die. But El Patron has no intention of dying. Not really. Because hidden on the edge of the poppy fields, in a little house watched over by a cook named Celia, there is a boy named Matt. For the first 6 years of his life, Matt knows almost nothing of the world. He has Celia, he has the fields, he has the quiet boundary of the house. He does not know why he must stay hidden. He does not know why people would fear him. He does not know that his existence is a secret designed by the richest and most powerful man in the country. Matt is not El Patron's son. He is not his heir. He is his clone. One day, children from the great house discover him. Amelia, Stephen, and Maria. Matt, desperate to reach them, smashes a window and jumps out, cutting his feet badly on the broken glass. He is carried to the Alacran mansion, and for a brief moment, he's treated like a wounded child. Then, they realize what he is. A clone. And suddenly Matt is no longer a boy. He's an animal. A thing. A mistake with a face. Mr. Alacran, El Patron's great-grandson, has him locked away in a filthy room where he is treated with less dignity than a pet. The family does not see a child, they see a biological object. Something grown for a purpose. Something that should never have been allowed to speak, learn, or feel. But when El Patron finds out, he is furious. Not because Matt has been abused, exactly, but because Matt belongs to him. So Matt is cleaned and clothed. He's educated and given his own room. He receives tutors. He receives protection. For the next several years, Matt lives inside the mansion like a prince in a prison. He is feared, hated, watched, and yet strangely favored. The servants whisper, the family recoils. Some people call him livestock. Others pretend that he's not even there at all. Only Maria sees him as human. Their friendship begins in childhood, awkward and strange, but over time it becomes something deeper. Maria becomes proof that Matt is not what everyone says he is, but the truth keeps circling him. Matt eventually learns what clones are supposed to be. They're not supposed to think. They're not supposed to grow into real people. Most clones, when they are born, are injected with a substance that destroys their minds. It lobotomizes them. It leaves them alive but ruined, drooling, helpless, brain-damaged bodies kept for one reason only: organ donation. Matt begins to understand the horror of his own existence. He was not created by love. He was manufactured, preserved, protected. Raised. But why? At first, he refuses to believe the obvious. Why would the old man educate him if he only planned to kill him? Why give him a mind if all he wanted was a body? Matt builds himself a comforting lie. Maybe El Patron wants him to inherit opium. Maybe he is being trained to rule. Maybe he's not a spare part after all. Then, at Stephen and Amelia's wedding, the illusion collapses. El Patron suffers a heart attack. The old monster's body finally begins to fail, and in the chaos, Matt and Maria try to escape. But they are betrayed. Maria is taken away, and Matt is dragged to the hospital. And there the truth is spoken quite plainly for all to hear. Matt was never meant to inherit anything. He was created to be harvested. His heart, his lungs, his organs. All of it belonged to El Patron from the beginning. Every kindness, every lesson, every moment of protection was just the careful maintenance of a living vault. Matt was not being raised as a son. He was being kept fresh. But Celia has known this day would come. For years, she has been secretly giving Matt tiny doses of arsenic. Not enough to kill him. Not enough to make him sick. Just enough to make his organs poisonous to the ancient man who planned to steal them. When this is revealed, El Patron is consumed by rage. The body he cultivated has been ruined. Matt escapes toward Aztlan, the land beyond Opium's border. In Aztlan, he finds the Lost Boys, orphans trapped under the control of the Keepers. A group of ideological fanatics who preach equality while living like kings. They force the boys to work plankton farms, feed them starvation food, and recite political doctrine about good citizenship and right-mindedness, while the keepers themselves enjoy comfort, power, and hypocrisy. At first, Matt is absolutely hated by the boys. To them, he looks like a spoiled aristocrat from Opium, a rich parasite, a soft-handed child from the house of the enemy. But Matt knows what it means to be owned. He knows what it means to be told that you're not human. And when he defies the keepers, something changes. Matt helps to lead a rebellion. He's punished, thrown into darkness, and eventually dumped into the Boneyard, a dead lake filled with whalebones. A place that feels less like a landscape and more like the exposed skeleton of the world. But he survives. He makes his way to San Luis to find Maria and her mother, Esperanza Mendoza, a powerful political figure who finally has the evidence she needs to bring down the Keepers. But Matt's story is not over. Opium has gone into lockdown. The border is sealed. The country is silent. Matt returns to the estate and finds the truth waiting for him like a final curse. The Alacran family is dead. At El Patron's funeral, they drank poisoned wine. Wine that the old man had saved for that very purpose. He never truly intended to leave his empire behind. If he could not live forever, then no one would inherit the world he built. Family, servants, loyalists, and enemies, all of them were disposable in the end. And so Matt stands in the ruins of the estate, the clone of the dead king, surrounded by the wreckage of a country built on drugs, slavery, genetic engineering, godlessness, and fear. The boy who was created to be spare parts becomes the ruler of the machine that made him. But he does not intend to preserve this machine. He intends to dismantle it, and that is where the real question begins. Can a person born from a monster's body escape a monster's destiny? Or does the throne always remake whoever sits on it? Can clones be redeemed, or are they doomed for destruction?
Two beautiful little Chinese girls.
This is the doctor who changed the future of the human race and let the world know on YouTube. He Jianquai stunned the scientific community with the claim he pushed the boundary no one else had.
A line has been crossed that should not have been crossed.
It's very disturbing. It's inappropriate.
Oh, this is huge.
He says he genetically edited human embryos, not just for research, but for implantation, leading to the world's first births of genetically altered humans, baby girls born in China from embryos designed to be resistant to HIV.
The method itself is very easy. You can use it, everyone can use it now.
Leaders in the field of gene editing have collectively agreed it's too early to implant edited embryos in humans because of the risks, the unknowns, and the ethical questions about altering humankind.
We're at a hinge of human history.
William Hurlbut is a leading American bioethicist who teaches at Stanford University. In the months before the news broke, Dr. He consulted with him.
Every time we met together, we would talk about the seriousness of the issues and in a sort of stepwise way, what you had to do to make sure that it was done right. But when I heard that there were live born children from it, I thought, oh my gosh, he just jumped ahead.
Despite its potential to aid the suffering of millions, the technique is controversial because the removal of stem cells leads to the destruction of the cloned embryo.
According to ancient Confucian ideas, a person is only truly considered to be a human after birth. Embryos or fetuses are not counted as human, and this idea has been around for thousands of years. So for Chinese studying cloning techniques to get stem cells, having to destroy many embryos is not a problem.
Even if it is not considered human, it is still a human embryo, and we must treat it in a proper way, according to ethics. We can't just do what we want with it, and that is why we have regulations in place.
While controversy over cloning human embryos for stem cells rages on in most of the world, the Chinese are keen to take the research to the next stage, and after this latest breakthrough, are now poised to become global leaders in the field. 2,000-year-old principles helping them combat 21st-century problems.
Do you support Israel?
These YouTube ads are getting out of control. They just jump out of nowhere sometimes. Let me just cut to the chase here. One of the stranger threads running through these most recently released Epstein files doesn't really have anything to do with just, you know, the typical evils, sex trafficking, cannibalism, child abuse, blackmail, all those types of things. It has to do with something that is fundamentally horrifying, like horrifying on a species level, like a species-wide level. That is, or was, or whatever, Epstein's interest in human engineering. And since today we're talking about clones, I thought, you know, I'm not going to make a full-blown Epstein episode because honestly it's getting tired, even though it is probably the most important story of the century. But regardless, I'm going to just pull a couple excerpts from the Epstein files to review and then go into more deeper clone related content, because there's a lot of weird stuff when it comes to clones, and I'm a believer. Okay, so this is a communication between a certain Brian Bishop and Jeffrey Epstein. The subject of the email is Designer Baby's Use of Funds. The email, dated August 5th, 2018, goes, attached is the doc you requested. It's the use of funds spreadsheet for the Designer Baby and Human Cloning Company. This gets us out of our self-funded garage biology phase to the first live birth of a human designer baby and possibly a human clone within 5 years. Once we reach the first birth, everything changes and the world will never be the same again, much less the future of the human species. Attached doc shows $1.7 million a year for up to 5 years, plus $1 million for lab setup, $9.5 million to fund 5 years, $6 million for 3 years. Next steps. I am happy to hop on another call, or I could take a trip to meet you in person. And if you have any thoughts about what I might be missing, or whether this is a reasonable estimate to get the first live birth, then I would really appreciate any feedback you have. I am traveling in Lithuania for August 7th through the 14th, and I'll probably be unreachable during that time. Thank you, Brian. But as we have come to learn about the psychopath, Mr. Epstein, he never says just one horrifying thing and just lets it be. He doubles down on the horror and says something even more horrifying to follow up with his previously horrifying statement. Jeffrey Epstein is having a discussion with somebody named Richard in this document here. Richard says something about clones. He says, I had images that the clones on channel whatever, to which Jeffrey responds, she didn't like that very much. And then Richard says, she wasn't here for the no arms. Jeffrey said, right, Katie Couric was here and we were talking about, I want to start cloning things, me. And with certain people, Prince Andrew got upset because he was all, if it had a conscience, could you kill it for spare parts? And I said, I'll make it without a head. Would that make you feel better? And Katie Couric, I thought, was going to start to vomit. Then Richard responds that they may evolve with a head or arms or feet so it couldn't get up and walk away. Jeffrey says, and did dishes. Richard, what? Jeffrey, did the dishes too, but you'd argue over a long period of time. A pressure like the limiting of the pelvic canal would make the brain more efficient, not necessarily a limiting factor. But another email regarding eugenics and cloning makes the situation even darker, because this Bishop guy that we mentioned in the first email, he discusses the need for absolute anonymity in this other email around investors and parents and benefactors and then, of course, the children themselves. So Epstein, to this, replies that he's got no issue with investing, but the problem is whether he would be seen as leading the effort. Bishop also floated the idea that the project could be placed under the public-facing banner of Designer Babies, because another unnamed deliverable used similar procedures and lab requirements, which would inevitably provide what he called sufficient deniability. In other words, we could do these experiments and say that we're experimenting on something else to sort of legally escape the punishments for what we're doing, which is a crime against humanity. This definitely fits, when you really start to think about it, the broader public reporting around Epstein's transhumanist and eugenic interests. Years earlier, for instance, The Guardian, citing the New York Times, reported that Epstein had this desire. He allegedly hoped to seed the human race with his DNA through women at his New Mexico ranch, some sort of Genghis Khan situation or something like that. So Epstein had this weird obsession. He had the money. He was willing to invest. He had access to scientists and academics and technology and biohackers and all of these crazy people who have no real morals and exist only to expand the boundaries of science. And this is an issue that people have had with Epstein for quite a while. He has this weird interest in modifying human beings for some reason. And so because of that documentation, we're able to see that this is something that goes that had been going on for quite some time, and no doubt was planned to continue to go on and is still going on. What Epstein's role in it now is unknown, but at least one person came to him with a concrete proposal that treated human cloning and designer babies as a legitimate fundable startup problem. Even though what Epstein talks about always sounds evil and sinister, because he talks about literally everything, even good things, with evil and sinister language, because most likely he was or is demonically possessed or a literal demon shapeshifter. He's not dead, by the way. He probably has a few clones of his own, too, I might add. Regardless, the problem is the powers that be can convince us, and do quite easily, that this stuff is good for us. Cloning is good for us. Biohacking is good for us, and it's good for humanity. The idea, they say, is that we just don't know that it's good for us yet. And that's just a scary speed bump that we're going to have to get over. It's a giant doorman we have to walk past to get to the good part on the other side. So, they say that cloning is actually pro-life. Alex Epstein is a philosopher who applies big picture humanistic thinking to industrial and environmental controversies. And he's not related to Jeffrey, allegedly. The last name is just a coincidence. But this guy, Alex, founded Center for Industrial Progress, which is a for-profit think tank and communications consulting firm that focuses on energy and environmental issues. Anyway, he says, consider first therapeutic cloning, which opponents perversely condemn as anti-life. Senator Sam Brownback, who has sponsored a congressional ban on all cloning, says therapeutic cloning is creating human life to destroy it. President Bush once called it growing human beings for spare body parts. In fact, therapeutic cloning is a highly pro-life technology, Alex says, since cloned embryos can be used to extract medically potent embryonic stem cells. These embryos are not human beings, but microscopic bits of protoplasm the width of a human hair, they say. They have the potential to grow into human beings, but actual human beings are the ones dying because of the lack of this technology. The embryonic stem cells extracted from a cloned embryo can become any other type of human cell. In the future, they may be used to develop pancreatic cells for curing diabetes, cardiac muscle cells for curing heart disease, brain cells for curing Alzheimer's, or even entire new organs for transplantation. And this was 20-some years ago, by the way, that this article came out. So what I'm reading for you right now is what they're talking about 20 years ago. The videos that you've already seen on this episode today, 15 to 20 years ago. Like, this is old news, what I'm talking about now. Opponents of therapeutic cloning know all of this, but are unmoved, and this is because their fundamental objection is not that therapeutic cloning is anti-life, but that it entails playing God, i.e. remaking nature to serve human purposes. Human cloning would be taking a major step into making man himself simply another one of the man-made things. Human cloning would be taking a major step into making man himself simply another one of the man-made things, says Leon Cass, who is chairman of the President's Council of Bioethics, or at least was 20 years ago. Human nature becomes merely the last part of nature to succumb to the technological project, which turns all of nature into raw material at human disposal. Columnist Armstrong Williams condemns all cloning as human egotism, or the desire to exert our will over every aspect of our surroundings, and cautions, "We are not God." Proponents of cloning say that the one truth in the anti-cloning position is that cloning does represent the desire to exert our will over every aspect of our surroundings. But that desire is not immoral. It is a mark of virtue. Using tech to alter nature is a requirement of human life, these people who would clone say. It is what brought man from the cave to civilization. Where would we be without the men who exerted their will over their surroundings and constructed the first hut, the first cottage, the first skyscraper, the first vaccine? Every advance in human history is part of the technological project and has made man's life longer, healthier, and happier. These advances are produced by those who hold the premise that suffering and disease are indeed a curse, not to be humbly accepted as quote-unquote, God's will, but to be fought proudly with all the power of man's rational mind. These cloners, those who would clone, go on to say the mentalities that denounce cloning and playing God have consistently opposed technological progress, especially in medicine. They objected to anesthesia, smallpox inoculations, contraception, heart transplants, in vitro fertilization, on the grounds that these innovations were all unnatural and contrary to God's will. So to let them cripple biotech progress by banning cloning would be a moral abomination, Alex Epstein goes on to say. But when it comes to playing God, they can go beyond the relatively tired concept of somebody being cloned over and over like a Blade Runner replicant. And we've all sort of gotten over the Duncan Idaho style questions of whether or not we will know if we are actually real or have a soul or whatever when we are a clone. But we have not adequately discussed how they could clone us into a digital environment. And that's where it gets just diabolical, because cloning somebody physically, that is one thing. Cloning somebody's conscience and their mind and their brain into a digital landscape that they cannot escape from and calling it immortality, well, that's something else entirely. Recently, Eon Systems PBC co-founder and founding advisor Dr. Alex Wissner Gross shared a look at some work on X, and this project is still very early. This is not a complete artificial animal, and it is not a perfect copy of a real fly, but it is indeed a digital fly with a real fly consciousness, the real consciousness of a fly digitally or something like that. It is the first step towards something bigger, they say, showing how a digital version of a brain might control a body inside a simulated world. So there you go. In this case, that body is a literal virtual fruit fly. And the goal is pretty simple to explain, simple enough, even if the science underneath it is completely unknowable and complicated. We're trying to connect a model of a fly's brain to a model of a fly's body and then let that body move, sense, and react and behave inside a computer-generated environment. And the project depends heavily on work done by the larger neuroscience community. So the people who are working on your brain are doing this. In the demo, the fly moves through a virtual environment toward a food source, shown as slices of banana. Along the way, simulated dust collects on the fly, and when enough dust builds up, then the fly stops and it grooms itself. And then after cleaning, it continues toward the food and begins eating. You know, typical fly activities. To make all this happen, these scientists connected two major things, a digital brain model and a digital body model. And the brain model is based on a mapped fruit fly brain. Scientists have already mapped roughly 140,000 neurons and around 50 million connections inside this adult fruit fly brain. And this map gives researchers a kind of wiring diagram, if you will. It doesn't explain everything by itself, but it gives up a serious starting point for asking how brain structure might produce behavior and how they could take advantage of that with other species. The body model comes from an existing virtual fruit fly called NeuroMech Fly. And this model gives the fly a detailed 3D body, and it's got joints, it can move realistically, there's outside natural forces that are digital, and it can also decide how to make contact with the ground, all that kind of stuff, how to fly. It was built using scans of a real fruit fly. So the body shape is obviously based on real anatomy, but you could theoretically put it in any body. You could have this fruit fly brain controlling an elephant body, I would imagine. In the system of this fruit fly, in this scientific system they've got going on, the virtual world sends information into the brain. So in the real world, we are responding to stimuli, and in this virtual world, the world itself is also sending information to the fruit fly brain. The brain model responds, and then certain brain outputs are translated into body movements. The fruit fly body moves, which changes
what the fly is sensing, and that new sensory information goes back into the brain. So the fly is not just playing on a pre-written animation or something like that. It is moving essentially in a loop, and it is sensing, processing, acting, sensing again, processing, acting again. And that loop is the heart of this entire project. Do you see how horrifying this sounds? So even though that other stuff that I was telling you about was maybe 15 to 20 years ago, this is relatively new. So we've gone beyond cloning, and now we're cloning into digital environments. That's what we're doing here. And we're connecting to bodies that aren't even ours and creating virtual brains and stuff like this. This virtual fly receives different kind of sensory information similar to what we would experience in real life. So for taste, the model can activate neurons that would normally respond to sugar or bitter substances. In a real fly, taste sensors are found on places like the legs and the mouth parts, obviously. So in the virtual fly, when the legs or mouth touch something sweet, that signal is sent into the brain model and can trigger feeding behavior. The scientists themselves compared the control that they have over the fly to kind of like driving a car. You don't really need to simulate every tiny explosion inside the engine to predict what the car will do. But if you know what the steering wheel, the gas pedal, and the brake are doing, you can understand a lot about the car's movement. So Eon says our fly model works something like that. We use a small set of brain outputs as control handles, and then we let the body model translate those signals into actual movements. And I'm sure right about now, you guys can easily imagine what kind of horrors this could spell for the human race, especially in like a prison or a punishment sort of capacity, right? Can you imagine being put into a mental prison like this? Can you imagine your brain being, your body is still there, but your brain is being put into a literal prison that you can't really escape from. Your eyes are sort of incapacitated. Your mental state is totally hijacked, and you are essentially living in a matrix without really knowing that you're living in a matrix because your brain has been hijacked. You are being transported into a sort of digital reality, despite the fact that you are already in a physical reality. This would basically eliminate the need for physical prisons in a lot of ways, because you can do this chemically, you can do this technologically. It completely eradicates the need for any sort of like physical restraining that you would have to do on a prisoner or somebody that you're trying to punish or interrogate or whatever the case may be. You can simply capture their mind in this digital environment, and they would basically be sitting still 100% of their life, but their brain doesn't know that they're sitting still. Their brain thinks they're running from demons. Their brain is trying to climb the same glass wall day in and day out, never getting any higher so that they can escape this bizarre reality that they have somehow found themselves in because they committed, let's just say, Grand Theft Auto or murder. What if the reason that nobody's been punished for the Epstein files, that they're not really concerned about the whole pedophilia, cannibalism aspect of this thing? That's why the predatory elite aren't pursuing those who did wrong. That's why the predatory elite are probably just continuing to do the same things that they were doing in the Epstein files, etc., etc. And what if it's all not really being done on humans in their original form, but on clones? What if these predatory elite are doing all of these terrible things to clones? And even though the original child or the original person that has been abducted to be experimented on is still an asset, the reason in the minds of the predatory elite, the reason that their conscience simply still allows them to function, because mine wouldn't. I would not be able to live with myself having done some of these things in these files, but theirs allows them to continue because either they are a clone already and they don't really have any emotional response to this, because when you clone somebody, as we know, a lot of their emotional state is just totally driven out of whack. And so their conscience is not really present in the clone. That's one thing. Or two, the people, the beings that they are doing all of these horrible things to, the beings that they are consuming, the beings that they are doing further experiments on, the beings that they are cutting into pieces, the beings that they are defiling and committing atrocities upon are clones. They're clones of the real people. I'm just saying, if all of this is 20-year-old research and they're already mapping brains into digital landscapes, guys, just think about the evil things that they're already, that they're willing to let us know that they're doing, and imagine why they might not be that concerned. It's because it barely scratches the surface of what they're actually doing. And they know that if we knew what they were actually doing, we would find them wherever they are, and we would destroy them. We would remove them from the planet. That's how you know that something strange is going on. The fact that they don't care about this type of stuff. In my last episode, I talked about how I found a weird backdoor into a really strange biohacker forum that has sort of covertly existed, I guess, for the past like 13 years. And all of these biohackers and scientists, they all update their research and their project data to this forum. It's a weird little forum. And all these people are very highly advanced and decorated scientists, very impressive and horrifying resumes. They are doctors, they are bioengineers, they are scientists. They are not neckbeards from Reddit. And it gives a more up-to-speed idea of what we are actually capable of in this modern time as opposed to like maybe 20 years ago, because it's directly from the source in real time. And I was poring over one of their endless chat logs because I was reading all their messages because I'm a freak. And there was one particular part that I was really intrigued by. At first glance, the log looks like nothing. Like, you have these usernames that are connecting and disconnecting. You have, they're telling jokes to each other that don't really make sense to me because I'm not in on it. I'm a spy. They're dropping links into the chat room for discussion, all this kind of stuff. But underneath all of that, there's a very clear theme that they are discussing. And this is a conversation among people who are interested, deeply focused. Their life mission is on transhumanism, genetic engineering, synthetic biology, and obviously the possibility of modifying human biology beyond its normal natural limits. Someone in the chat shares a paper about scientists using directed evolution to make an enzyme form carbon-silicon bonds. And that's something that biology doesn't normally do. In nature, life is built mostly around carbon and oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, sulfur, and phosphorus, all the things that we learned about in school. Silicon is everywhere on Earth, but living organisms don't normally use carbon-silicon bonds in their biochemistry. So the strange implication is that if enzymes can be evolved to build carbon-silicon molecules, then biology can be pushed into chemical territory that natural evolution never entered and probably never would find a way to enter, even if science was left to do the thing that they say science does. So this isn't silicon-based life in the sci-fi sense, but it is a step toward making living systems perform chemistry that once could only have been performed in laboratories. I don't know if I'm making any sense with this. But then their conversation shifts into something more uncomfortable, and that's that of human genetic engineering. Obviously, these two topics go hand in hand. Someone notes that people have been trying to replace the phrase human genetic engineering with softer language, like germinal choice technology. Another person in the chat says human genetic engineering sounds like designer babies, eugenics, and laboratory-made children. Germinal choice technology sounds more academic, medical, and almost therapeutic. Same sort of general territory, but completely different emotional reaction, right? And then they joke around with other phrases like fetal rescue, embryonic preservation, and little people rescue. So even the scientists who believe that this is like an inherently pro-life thing, they joke about how it's not really. It's not really. They can't even keep the fact that they may be killing babies out of their jokes. Which kind of just goes to show you, when you really think about it, that if you if you're focusing on these types of topics, even if you are able to convince yourself long enough to write a paper about it and post it in some science magazine somewhere that almost nobody except sciencey people who agree with you will ever read it, you still can't keep the morbid, macabre, disgusting jokes out of your mind about how you're killing something to create something out of it. Obviously, that's not what God does when he creates. He doesn't need to destroy something to create something more. But this pro-life movement in the cloning industry will say, oh no, this is pro-life, while joking about how it's a fetal rescue, embryonic preservation, little people rescue. Underneath the jokes is a very serious point, though. Biotech debates are shaped by euphemism. Whoever controls the language over what this technology is called controls how threatening the idea feels. Regardless, even the people who are inventing these processes understand that the little people are in danger. This is scary territory. Very, very scary and completely humanly insensitive territory. But the basic question that they're trying to answer is probably not how do we control a human brain so that we can put it into a prison. It is something more along the lines of, could you improve human biology? There's somebody in the chat at this point who points out that blindly making enzymes more powerful could be dangerous because the body is a network. So if one enzyme suddenly works 100 times faster, the rest of the system may not be prepared for it. And then you could create toxic buildup, disrupt feedback loops, or overload metabolic pathways, and maybe that's when you would start to see clones like those that belong to Kanye West or Ariana Grande or any of these other political figures that we see. Maybe that's when you see their clones begin to sort of not perform in the way that you would expect a normal person to perform in. That's when they spaz out. That's when their eyeballs start doing weird motions. That's when their hands start making weird things. That's when they, weird signs. That's when their faces don't really, aren't really working properly. That's when they all of a sudden zone out and they go completely statue, right? Perhaps. I'm thinking out loud here. But when we see them experimenting on mice and cats and dogs and dolphins and horses and flies, and we think to ourselves, well, you know, it's very bad for them, but at least they're not experimenting on us. What's up with all the human trafficking that never gets solved? What's up with everything that was happening in the Epstein files? They're not experimenting on humans, you say? Oh yes, they are experimenting on humans, and those humans are most likely never found again or turned into things that are completely unrecognizable or reutilized as MKUltra assassins because they're going through processes of cloning and brain control. And these scientists, they say stuff like, all of our science is just leading to the realm where humans can use or borrow or engineer enzymes from lower life forms to increase the abilities of our own. So cats can see in the dark. So if we are able to reverse engineer their ability to see in the dark and attach it to a human body, then humans will be able to see in the dark and all that kind of stuff. That's what that the human body becomes, the ultimate machine. How do we get humans to fight better? How do we get humans to work better? How do we get humans to produce more product? How do we get humans to ignore their morals? How do we get humans to just do what we want them to do whenever we want them to do it without any risk to us ever coming to fruition? Now, while I was researching clones and looking for people I hadn't heard of who had been cloned or potentially knew something about cloning that I didn't know anything about or that I hadn't heard, because I don't really just like going and reposting the same celebrity stories and clips of celebrities not being able to control their eyeballs or spacing out on stage. I don't need to hear more about, you know, Justin Bieber or Katy Perry or, you know, Clintons and going back into all the same old videos that they have of them malfunctioning and all that kind of stuff. I didn't want to do all that. So I'm about to tell you a story from a guy named Donald Marshall, who was allegedly a former Illuminati insider turned internet whistleblower. And I came across Donald Marshall's online posts detailing his firsthand accounts with a powerful global organization known as the Illuminati, okay? Whatever it is, he describes it as the Illuminati. And he describes their secret involvement in criminal acts like murder, kidnapping, torture, child abuse, child exploitation, all the ones that we have come to know and expect from our overlords. And as a victim himself of this group known that he calls the Illuminati, Marshall details his own experiences of torture and kidnapping and abuse at the hands of this large global conspiracy. And it reaches shocking levels of depravity. I'm just going to warn you. Marshall exposes many major Illuminati political figures in his story, including Queen Elizabeth, her husband Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Charles, the Russian President Vladimir Putin. And he also names many other world leaders and politicians and famous celebrities that were secretly or are secretly involved. Now, many of Marshall's claims can be substantiated by events that have been cataloged by public and private organizations, such as the Child Abuse Recovery, which is a division of the Trauma Research Center, and the International Common Law Court of Justice in Brussels, which found Queen Elizabeth and her husband, Prince Philip, guilty in the disappearance of 10 Native children from the Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia on October 10th, 1964. But that is a story for another time. Once again, where are all the children going? Why are the elites so deeply involved in child trafficking? So let's get into Donald Marshall's story a little bit here.
Conspiracy theorists have long contended that major world events are under the direction of a powerful global coalition of wealthy secret societies known collectively as the Illuminati. They hold that this shadow government has been orchestrating world events for many years, long promoting a hidden agenda, which includes the ultimate control of all areas of society, from banking, business, politics, military, education, religion, medicine, media, and entertainment. Donald Marshall has risked his life to speak out about this select group of individuals who, he says, maintains world control without the majority of the public made even aware. He says that their vast member base includes royal bloodlines, prominent wealthy families, influential members of finance, banking, and entertainment, as well as religious leaders and politicians and people in media, all of whom agree to join and participate within the organization. He explains that while members within this elite club enjoy access to unlimited opportunities, in exchange, they must agree to participate in secret meetings held nightly.
In deep underground military bases on highly restricted property. There, they utilize top secret cloning technology to meet as clones during their dream state to discuss and plan future events while the rest of us sleep. Marshall states that the practice of human cloning is far from new, and maintains that covert experiments in genetic engineering have been conducted by Illuminati scientists for many decades. And he explains that the beginning in the 1940s, human cloning technology was used as a way for world leaders to meet in secret in order to plan and discuss future events. But over time, they got bored and they began to clone others and bring them to the cloning center as well, such as famous movie stars and artists and musicians and celebrated sports figures. And they were all cloned and personally delivered to be Illuminati in order to indulge their every fantasy. Marshall says that in time, this slowly degraded as members began showing off for the rest, which resulted in committing shocking acts of depravity, including crimes and murder, kidnapping, torture, rape, child abuse and exploitation, and Marshall claims to have witnessed many crimes committed by numerous members of the Illuminati since early childhood as an unwilling participant in many covert government projects. He states that he remembers attending these secret meetings as a child as young as 5 years old. But while Marshall can relate in detail the events that took place at the cloning center every night, he reports that he could never remember how he actually got there, and at the time believed that he had maybe been kidnapped during his sleep. Now, Marshall says that he had no understanding of a top secret technology known as REM-driven consciousness transfer, which is used to transfer one's individual consciousness during the natural REM cycle of sleep into an identical clone located at a cloning center that is many miles away. Marshall explains that when he goes to bed at night, his consciousness is essentially stolen while he sleeps and is held hostage until his real body wakes up. And he maintains that this consciousness transfer happens almost every night, even though his real body never actually leaves the room and continues to sleep throughout the night. Once his real body eventually wakes up, though, his clone body drops limp. Marshall says that all those black, and as he wakes up, his consciousness quickly returns to his real body. Marshall claims that this transfer can only take place once the brain has fully entered the REM sleep cycle. Once you begin to dream, he says, they can steal your consciousness and bring you wherever they want. As Marshall reports, I go to sleep at night at home in Eastern Canada, and an hour later I open my eyes to find myself naked on a stainless steel rack at a cloning center hundreds of miles away.
In 1997, embryologists at the Roslin Institute in Scotland announced that they had successfully cloned a young sheep named Dolly from a cell taken from the mammary gland of an adult sheep. Public reaction to the news was obviously swift. The story was on the front page of the New York Times. It dominated television and talk shows around the world, and people were not so sure that this was a good thing. Bill Clinton immediately stated that the cloning of Dolly raised serious ethical questions, and there was all sorts of issues that went on. Marshall, of course, claims to have seen this cloning firsthand because he was an unwilling participant since childhood, and he says that elite scientists in every country all over the world use this top-secret cloning technology to create identical human clones that can be used in a variety of ways. Marshall explains that the public never sees any of this because all cloning activity takes place many levels below the ground on government-owned property with highly restricted access. Maybe places like the national parks, right? Who knows? Maybe under the ocean, under bodies of water, where it's just like physically impossible for normal people to even go, even if the water is only slightly deep. Marshall remembers visiting many of these military bases as a child, but he didn't realize that he was a clone at the time that he was visiting these bases. Since clone bodies, he say, feel as real bodies do. It wasn't until he was much older that he was given a tour of the grow rooms, a deep level underground of entire floors where human clones are grown in the dark, suspended in water, or stacked in glass tubes. Marshall reports that the grow rooms are dark, dirty, and reek of the smell of urine, and he explains that elite scientists usually create a series of the same clones at a time, selecting the best and disposing of the rest, since each body requires only 5 months and $30 to reach full completion. Marshall further explains that there are many kinds of cloning technology used to grow different types of clones. In replication cloning, top secret scientists create the ideal conditions in the lab for new life to grow, resulting in a perfectly formed baby clone. However, this process is time consuming, as the baby clone will still need to grow and develop as any other human baby. Instead, duplication cloning is preferred, whereby manipulating certain gene mutations, clone bodies can be quickly grown to full maturity in a matter of months and can be used immediately. This is the type that you might see with celebrities and politicians on TV. But in reality, clone organs are grown too fast, according to Marshall, and are not viable for use in organ transplant. What's more, he claims the science of human cloning is deeply flawed, with serious side effects, as clone behavior tends to be unpredictable and erratic, with very little impulse control, as we see on TV. Apparently, even Dolly, the cloned sheep, suffered serious side effects from the flawed science of cloning, and soon after news of the successful experiment in cloning was released, Norwegian daily newspaper Dagbladet headlined, "Dolly is eating herself to death," claiming that Dolly the sheep could not stop eating and was more than twice the size of her litter mates, a direct consequence of something that happened during this cloning process. When it comes to human cloning, one of the important questions to ask, one of arguably the most important question to ask, is what does it actually mean to be human? And Donald Marshall says that it can be difficult to answer this question because it's hard to tell if you are a clone or not, since as a clone, your body and your memories and feelings seem as if they are real. He says they seem real as real feels. He says that members of the Illuminati feel that they can use your clone in any way they choose, since they believe that clones are not actually natural born humans, and therefore they actually have no human rights. In truth, though, many people don't realize the fact that they don't actually own their DNA, and this is just this is a real life horror, as if you can go ahead and convince yourself the rest of this is fake. But as of 2013, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office have assigned the ownership of a variety of human genetic codes to private corps and universities in the United States. And according to editor Mike Adams of naturalnews.com, more than 4,000 human genes so far, which is up to 20% of our complete genetic code, by the way, is literally owned by someone else. So the corporation that owns the most patents, which is called Insight, is a biopharmaceutical company based in Delaware, and it owns the patents on over 2,000 human genetic codes. So while most people would not be willing to necessarily sell their DNA, it is legal regardless for dozens of private corporations to claim ownership over every single cell in our bodies, and those claims would be completely upheld if challenged in a U.S. court of law, and that is the real horror. You don't own nothing, you will own nothing, and you will be happy, and that includes your very body. So one can only wonder what the future will hold. If private corporations have the legal permission to actually use our DNA to clone any member of the population for their own purpose, or what exactly the limitations on this are if it's already entered the legal space. So, before he died, why did nobody get this guy, Marshall, to show us where these deep underground military bases might be? He claims that there are cloning centers built in deep underground military bases all over the world. He also says that his cloning center is reserved for only very elite members of the Illuminati and come with special privileges, such as the arena that is built above ground, which allows access to fresh air and natural light for the clones, as opposed to those establishments that are deep underground. What's more, since only the very famous attend this center, allegedly, all activities are videotaped and sent by military satellite to the other cloning centers around the world. And even though Marshall has been activated here nightly since he was very small, he says he was only allowed to go outside on two different occasions. "I looked around," he remembers. "I saw nothing but grass, a dirt road, and trees. No sign of any civilization, no air traffic, no smoke on the horizon. Nothing." And forget trying to search the location using Google Earth, he says. They blocked it. They showed us a satellite view one time of the cloning center on the big screens in the arena, and then they just masked the center by overlaying images of nearby trees. So it just looks like there's more trees. The center completely disappeared. They did it in front of everybody. Marshall maintains, too, that cloning centers are driven by reels. They are powered by clones who do all of the work, all of the maintenance, and all of the cleanup. These clones are stored on site and activated to work at the cloning center during the dreams without any pay or compensation. And you thought your job sucked. This reminds me of this robot that my dad was trying to build this one time. My dad, for a while, he liked to build robots, and he tried to build these, or he told me about this idea for robots that he had that would essentially, they would build each other, and they were really little robots. They would build each other, and then they would multiply, and then they would be used to build bigger structures, all sorts of bigger structures, anything on the planet. He thought this would be really good for, like, going to Mars and other planets and stuff like that, because you could just you could just airdrop or missile or launch or whatever a box of these robots into an area, and then they would receive signals or have some sort of database somehow that would inform them of what they should build now that they are on the ground, wherever they are, or what they should disassemble, or how many of them they should create, all of this kind of stuff. And this kind of reminds me of that, using clones for the same exact purpose. You build a clone facility, you create clones, you teach those clones to create more clones and to run the whole entire system. And these clones, according to Marshall, are stored on site and they are activated to work at the cloning center during their dreams. So that makes sense because it makes it seem like these are employees of this one place. These clones, they never leave. Marshall claims that there are a few reels that run stuff, but you barely ever see them. They stay out of harm's way because clones can malfunction and attack at any time. While the reels need to always be careful, there are safeguards in place should a clone start to display erratic behavior. Marshall explains that each clone has a built-in auto shutoff and can be quickly deactivated. What's more, in the case of emergency, they can utilize a mass shutdown feature and shut down all the clones with the push of a button. He explains that all clones start degrading and need to be replaced from time to time, depending on how much wear and tear is inflicted on the clone. Maybe that's what we see all the time with these celebrities and these politicians who just lose it. But in other words, if you drive it like a rental, many backup clones will be needed. But those that just sit and watch, those will need only about one replacement a year, he says. Either way, clone disposal is an ongoing chore at the cloning center, where human clones are disposed of daily, some due to degradation, some due to lost battles in the pit, and according to Marshall, even too much sex can ruin a clone. One convenient method of disposing of many clone bodies is to toss them into a chipper, which Marshall describes as a huge garbage disposal set up on a big dumpster. That is really quite something, Marshall. And according to Marshall, they are always searching for fresh young bodies. They procure from anywhere and everywhere, from places such as hospitals, healthcare facilities, rehab centers, prisons. In fact, anywhere people are locked in, drugged up, or tuned out can provide opportunities for body snatching. And Marshall claims that all this takes place with the support of these Illuminati members embedded within all levels of law enforcement and legal and medical professions. And don't think you're safe from being body snatched just because you're one of them, he says, because they even steal bodies from among their own member base, since there are always fresh new faces joining all the time. And he explains that young people agree to join with the promise of fame and fortune. What they are not told is that their physical body can also be included in the deal. Should a privileged member, he says, decide that your body looks fun and lively, they might just body snatch you and hand over your body as a reward for faithful service. This is especially true should your fame and popularity start to fade over time. What happened? Did your TV show get canceled? Not selling out any more stadiums? Your album isn't doing well? Well, you still look mighty cute to the old and sick shopping for their next body, so get on over here, Doja Cat. Marshall claims that many famous celebrities and well-known politicians are still with us in a manner of speaking, but they are unrecognizable and they are wearing the bodysuit of some poor, unfortunate soul. When it comes to microchips, a lot of us are worried about the microchip future, the Neuralink future, the chips that they're going to put in our body. I don't know how real any of this Marshall talk is. I believe that he had an experience because there's an entire movement about him, but according to him, life as a microchip head comes with quite a few surprises, and for reasons unknown, elite scientists have been truly unable to design out the tendency for chip heads to revert to a primitive state and take sport in herding, hunting, and eating people, including children. So you come back all right, he says, but you come back as a sick, twisted pervert. I wonder if that's what's going on in the upper class. Marshall says that the world elite don't get too hung up over questions about right or wrong. It's more like, what can they get away with? And since they place their members within all levels of every field in society, they can get away with quite a bit. So, what does immortality feel like? Perhaps we are all asking the wrong question. Just because we can doesn't mean we should. For now, the life is still in the blood. Thanks for listening.